I think we'll get this out of the way, that there's no financial relationship in terms of the anything which I'm presenting today. What I want to focus this morning in terms of the next 15 minutes or so is to provide an overview, which will probably be good for the subsequent speakers. The first objective is to discuss the burden of chronic diseases in terms of morbidity, mortality, and disability among women in the United States. So the focus is predominantly, I would say almost exclusively, on women in the United States, because we do have other presentations where it's much more global. Explain the gender inequities faced by women in accessing and utilizing health care and the resultant impact on women's health. And the third objective is to specify the need for primary prevention and its utility in reducing the burden of chronic diseases among women. And then identify effective prevention strategies for addressing chronic diseases in women to promote their health and well-being. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with what are the NCDs or the CNCDs, as they are called. Either called the chronic non-communicable diseases or they are called the non-communicable diseases. There's some challenge in terms of the term itself now, and one of the World Bank report questions this whole notion of why call it NCDs, because there's also an infectious component to it. For example, when we think about the cervical cancer, human papillomavirus is the one which is very intricately associated with the occurrence of cervical cancer. So there are some questions in terms of whether that's the most appropriate term. So I'm thinking that this might be a field which might emerge, and probably in the next meeting or so we might have a different term for it. But what are CNCDs? CNCDs are the diseases which have a long duration, and that's the chronic portion of it. They're generally slow progression, show slow progression, and they are the major cause of adult mortality and morbidity worldwide. So what are the main diseases? It's not the whole list, and I'll say why it is not the whole list, is because we can have, if you look at the ICD-10, there's a whole slew of diseases which could be fitting into it. But when we think in terms of priorities, in terms of the impact which we can make by tweaking some of them, I think these ones stand out. And even within this list, we'll get shorter, as you will see in the next slide. So it's heart disease, cancer, stroke, chronic respiratory diseases, including COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and asthma, and of course diabetes, which is on the rise. So in case of the women, what are the three top ones? The three top ones are the heart disease, cancer, and stroke. And why are these three chosen? Is because they account for over 50% of the deaths which take place among women. And in terms of the morbidity and the disability due to them is also very high. And that's the reason when we think about women, we are thinking about these three things. It never surprises me, because I teach, and one of the things I always ask people is, what's the most important killer of women in the United States in terms of disease conditions? And I often get the answer, breast cancer. So then I'll ask them, like, okay, which is the type of cancer which causes most deaths among women? And I'll get breast cancer. And the reality is both those answers are not true. Heart disease is the number one killer of women, and then if you look at it in terms of the what type of cancer kills most women, it is lung cancer, and the intersection of the lung cancer and the breast cancer curve took place in 1987, and we are in 2012. So it is sometimes the education which we think is occurring, in spite of all the information which is put forth, sometimes is based on what people perceive and what they repeatedly get as the message, and that often is something which we should think about. I'm sorry for the cover graph, but it gives a good portrayal of a couple of things over here. There are three things which I want to point out over here. I'll use my finger, but that's not going to help very much. But so I will use the mouse. Here's the mouse. The three things which I want to mention is that if you see the title of the presentation, it says lifespan. So obviously a question arises that why should we take a lifespan approach, and some people call it the life course approach. The reason is all those three conditions which we talked about, they're not caused by one agent or one factor, risk factors. We have a commonality of multiple risk factors for those, and then if we were to summarize it in one phrase, we will call them the lifestyle factors. We'll call them the lifestyle factors. And lifestyle factors often are formed early in childhood. If you didn't eat broccoli, you could become the president of the United States and you may still not eat broccoli, right? So it's the same thing with a number of other vegetables and fruits, and that is one of the reasons why we want the habits to form early. That's one side of the story. The other side of the story is there's a lot more evidence now that when we think about heart disease, and then especially in terms of atherosclerosis and some of the other processes which occur, those processes are not suddenly magically appearing at the age of 40 or 50 in case of women, but those things are being laid out even in the first and the second decade of life. So it makes a tremendous, tremendous sense to think about these lifestyle factors and what should be shaped to a certain extent, of course, with the individual's voluntary adoption of those behaviors should be taking place at the younger age groups. And that's one of the things which I want to point out over here. If you see the needs of the... I apologize, the mouse has gone for a little visit somewhere else.
Maybe it went back to New York.
Yeah, here it is. So the when you look at the 18 to 44 and then the 45 to 64, you see this dramatic change. You see the dramatic change. And in terms of arthritis, arthritis, of course, is one of the most common conditions, both among males and females, as we become older, because it is, to a certain extent, a degenerative condition. And similarly, when you see the high cholesterol and hypertension, there certainly is a different need for women at this age group and women at this age group. And, of course, only data is presented for this. If you take the data for 65-plus, then certainly all these chronic conditions actually increase. So, but the message is clear. The message is that we need to look at the... look at different age groups differently. So the second variable over here is the poverty level, and you can see that if it is less than 200% of the poverty, whatever might be the family size, accordingly the federal poverty and the income is going to change. But you can see that if the poverty is, less than 200% of poverty, that means poorer, there seems to be a higher prevalence of these conditions. And we now know that for the NCDs particularly, there seems to be a very close correlation with poverty. So poorer people are likely to have more of these conditions, even though we think of these diseases as the diseases of industrialization. When we look at it globally, not in the United States, when you look at it globally, there are more people who have it in the higher socioeconomic status, but the people who more people die when they have it in the lower socioeconomic status, women are adversely affected by this condition. So poverty is an important variable. And the third thing which I wanted to mention is the race and ethnicity, and you can see the dramatic, dramatic difference which you see, and all these things, little asterisks, means that these are statistically significant. So when we think about women, we shouldn't be thinking about women as a homogeneous group. That's the message which I wanted to point out over here. When we think about any kind of risk factors, we think about risk factors in terms of these two categories. One is which we can modify and which we cannot modify. I can lie about my age, I can probably change my gender, I can disown my relatives, but none of that is going to make any impact in terms of the NCDs. And the modifiable ones are mentioned over here. They are the tobacco use, insufficient physical activity, alcohol, misuse, unhealthy diet. Why are they bolded? They are bolded because these four are intricately associated with the three diseases, the three NCDs which we talked about before, cancer, heart disease, and stroke. And that's the reason why they are mentioned. And these ones could often be a result of what is occurring over here. For example, if the insufficient physical activity is there and combined with the unhealthy diet, my mouse is running around now, that might lead to overweight and obesity. So what I'm trying to say is, even though it is presented in some kind of a linear fashion in terms of how frequently it is going to occur, but they are all intricately, they are all pieces of the same puzzle. They are all pieces of the same puzzle. And it is possible for any woman to have more than one of these risk factors, and usually people have multiple risk factors present in the same person. This gives the prevalence of major modifiable risk factors. You can see that almost 1 in 2 has lack of physical activity. Smoking is about 1 in 6. And then about 1 in 8 is alcohol use. That is what one would call as the harmful alcohol use. And that you can see over here. Instead of showing you the... I couldn't get the exact data for that in terms of consumption of fruits and vegetables. I found this, and this might be a useful way to look at it. And you will see two things over here. One is the yellow bars are the adults, and the green bars are the adolescents. And as you can see, that adolescents somehow don't seem to favor vegetables as yet. As they grow up, obviously they're going to be. At my age, you eat vegetables. You do eat it. the prevalence of obesity, and that's a dramatic change. Again, pointing to the need for looking at segmenting the women in terms of their age group or in terms of race, economic status, or in terms of poverty and other variables, in addition to all the other variables which we usually look at it in the on the clinical side of the spectrum, is that you can see the dramatic increase in terms of the prevalence of obesity. We're not talking about overweight. This is obesity. This is obesity which we're looking at, and that's much, much higher than what you see in the age group. So women's health insurance coverage, that's an important one, and I put this over here mainly to point out one thing, and that is this. About 62 or 63% of us get our health insurance because we work. Not that others are not working, but we are fortunate to work in places and work for so many hours that our employers are able to provide us health insurance. But in case of women, there is one caveat, and that caveat is oftentimes they are dependent on their partner or spouse to get that health insurance. You don't see that if the same pie were to be created for men, but it is important for women. So if there are some life changes, for example, there's separations, for example, if there is whatever might be, if the person loses the job, the spouse loses the job, then obviously they are going to come into this category of 1/5 of the women who are uninsured. Thank you. So what does that mean? Why is that important, the insurance? Because then the screening, you can see that the screening percentages changes. One thing which we have to be careful about is that we cannot simply directly compare the screening percentages, even though it looks as if it has been done, because the recommendations for screening varies. For example, pap smear is much more important in the younger age group, whereas mammogram is much more important in the older age group. Same thing goes for colorectal cancer. Colorectal cancer, obviously, we are going to be looking at 50-plus rather than an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old. So that's something to keep in mind. But the point which I want to show over here is the uninsured. You can see that the uninsured, when it comes to the screening practices, they are greatly at a disadvantage. And if you are talking about changing the modifiable risk factors, then we certainly need to make sure that at least we detect it early and then we manage it properly and we manage it comprehensively and continuously for the rest of the woman's life. And that is the major challenge. So there's an urgent need. I hope I have convinced everyone that there's an urgent need to reduce the risk factors, and the modifiable risk factors will continue to increase. Now, if you wonder why it should continue to increase, there are some forces which on the surface look good, and they are good. We all want to live longer. Botox is very helpful. But the point is that increasing population also means that many of the diseases, and at least the three top ones which I mentioned, are going to increase. The second thing is that we are also increasing in the we are aging population. People call it the graying, and I think you're looking at one. But what occurs in the graying population is because many of these are degenerative conditions, age-related conditions, so they are also going to increase. Then the presence of barriers to initiate and or maintain risk reduction is a challenging thing. It is a challenging thing. There are people who will say that, look, I have gotten on weight management, I have done smoking cessation for 20 times. So what are you talking about? It is a problem that they have done it 20 times instead of doing it once and then staying quit. And those are some of the challenges which you see. But the good news is that if we can prevent, if we can screen, treat, and care, we can attack this. And the results are very impressive. And the last one, which often people look at, which is very helpful, is to look at the dollar signs. When we say that, oh, it is going to cost, then of course the policymakers look at it. There's one thing which I want to point out. These are not data only for women. These are data for both men and women together. And that's why it is. And these are relatively older data too, and you can put a little bit of increase in terms of the cost. But the costs are really, really, really high. Costs are high. So what are some of the ingredients for successful interventions to combat CNCDs? The thing is, we need to have a well-defined target while addressing risk factors from several angles. For example, if you are thinking about smoking cessation, it is not just adequate to tell people that you should not be smoking, which is education. You should also be bringing them in terms of smoking cessation programs, which is a direct intervention. But at the same time, there has to be some policies. For example, if you're going into some places, you cannot smoke. Restaurants, you cannot smoke. Public spaces, you cannot smoke. Making it difficult, but that looks punitive. And many of our policies are that way. We are going to impose a heavy tax on tobacco so that you wouldn't be able to afford it, and then you have to probably split your cigarette into two and then smoke it till it burns out. But the idea is that there's not one approach. The second point, which is buried in that, is it's not necessarily just to look at the smoking cessation, it is time to also talk about the other risk factors at the same time. So the person is able to adapt not just one risk factor reduction, but maybe wanting to manage the weight at that point in time, but not ready to quit smoking. So it is an opportunity in terms of intervention which cannot be simply on one, but it should be high. Give high-profile leaders a central role in driving initiatives. There are a number of examples of it. We have always used, starting from Katie Couric when her husband passed away. She had a colonoscopy on television. If you didn't catch it, you go to YouTube and you'll find out, you'll get a glimpse of it. But the point here is that it has really helped in terms of the increasing the awareness about FERC. But the awareness doesn't last for long, and that's where the consistent message and the continuous nature of the message is important. First Lady Michelle Obama has been a champion in terms of increasing physical activity, having a good dietary pattern, and you can see that those things are important and those things are visible, they are visible, and when they do it, there's more going to be a lot more awareness, and to a certain extent, there's going to be an increased acceptance of those. Be opportunistic, identify indirect impacts on health and obstinate impact. For example, if we do some kind of if something occurs in another sector, for example, we are talking about wage parity. For what a man earns for the same amount of work, a woman earns somewhere between 72 cents to 78 cents, depending on where you are. And there is a great need, and I don't know why it hasn't occurred still in 2012, when you bring both people to the same, it is going to have some spin-off effects in terms of affordability of healthcare, in terms of utilization of healthcare. We have to identify wins for non-health stakeholders. This is important because when we, for example, the minute we say that soda tax, for example, 1 penny per ounce, someone is getting hurt. At least they feel, oh, my profit margin is getting lower. But how do we make sure that their profit margin is actually not going to be affected? If people are living longer, they are going to drink more soda, right? But less amounts. Not the 64 ounces, but probably 6 ounces. And that's the thing to look at. And finally, they ensure that different actors focus on what they do best. It is impossible to, when you think about chronic diseases, we don't think about a magic bullet, a vaccine. We got multiple things, and these are very personal to us. It's not as easy as rolling up the sleeve or opening our mouth to get the vaccine. This is something which is very dear to us, and food is very cultural. Food is very personal. Exercise, the whole notion of exercise is very personal, and we need to look at that. So what are some of the policy implications? We need to make healthcare coverage affordable. We need to make health insurance coverage available, because that's what determines healthcare, whether we are able to access and utilizing it. And then prevention services. 15 years ago, many of you know about this. If you wanted to get a mammogram, you have to fight with the insurance agency. Things have eased out, but there's still a lot of fight which has to be done. And then finally, meet the changing and different needs of women based on various attributes, which I already mentioned it. So in conclusion, women are more vulnerable to developing chronic conditions. Women are more likely to face social and economic situations that can adversely affect their access to utilization of healthcare services. But the best thing is, if women are healthy, they're going to take care of the whole family. And that is the key. And that is the spin-off effect, the return on investment, which everybody wants to see. I think that is the benefit which we need to look at more closely and do some research on it. And the lifespan approach pays economic dividends and, more importantly, contributes to better quality of life, more than just the longevity, better quality. Thank you. Thank you.